From WBUR Boston and WRNI Providence, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. It's Friday night, and we are tracking the classic arc of war through the eyes and ears of Hollywood, from modern battles to the days of the gladiators.
At my signal, unleash hell.
From burning spears in ancient Rome to fighter jets over deserts today, the many faces of war are a permanent Hollywood fascination. War films have lauded the honor of sacrifice and the valor of battle in films like Patton and Gettysburg. They've shown the brutality and tragic consequences of war in films like Born on the Fourth of July and Platoon. Decade by decade, film by film, Hollywood has tracked the full life cycle of armed conflict. From pre-war innocence to the stirring call to arms to the wild battle, through victory and defeat, pride, disillusionment, and suffering. Tonight, we're looking at the arc of war through Hollywood's eyes to harvest again the hard learning captured in a century of film. Joining me tonight in the studio is our valiant movie maven, Garen Daly, film critic and artistic director at the Dedham Community Theater in Dedham, Massachusetts. Welcome, Garen Daly.
Hi, Tom. How are you doing?
Great. And with us from Hanover, New Hampshire tonight is On Point News analyst Jack Beatty, senior editor at the Atlantic Monthly Magazine. Welcome to the movies, Jack.
Hello, Tom, and hello, Garen.
Hey, Jack.
Jack, Garen, I want to put a big question to you. Right off the bat, we're going to talk a lot about movies and hear a lot of movies tonight. But top line question, and Garen, I'll put it to you first. On balance, does Hollywood glorify war or cut it down to size?
It really depends on what era we're talking about. You know, during World War II, they glorified war. They wanted to make us get ready to be patriotic, to go out and fight the nasty people out there. In the 60s, it brought it down to size because it became a personal tragic event. So Hollywood goes back and forth in depending on the political climate at the time.
And yet, Jack, of course, one of the strange things about film is that it, unlike a theater performance, film doesn't ever go away, or not much of it. So on balance, where do you think the needle lies?
Well, that's a very good point. I mean, it's simultaneously available to us, isn't it?
We can still go watch John Wayne and the Green Berets.
Right, right. I do think that on balance, it does glorify it, if only because it shows the individual, the star, you know, the personality. Mm-hmm. Even if the star is suffering, it's sort of Technicolor suffering. It's Hollywood suffering. Mm-hmm. And only in the grimmest of films, like Born on the Fourth of July, that actually takes us into a VA hospital that's strapped for funds, do we really see the consequences of war. So that's, I think, a relatively recent and rare note. But on the whole, I think the focus on personality and the star makes it, it does tend to glorify war.
We so much feel ourselves right now locking in to this arc. We know how it goes. In fact, we're already in it. We've been in it for a while. The run-up, the rumbling, the rumbling of war that we've been in for months now. Hollywood has dealt with that for a long time. We're going to look at films, how they've captured each piece of that. And one piece we've got here, Garen, comes from Gone with the Wind. And it's none of the battle scenes. It's all before the battle that we'll look at here.
Yeah, just about every single Hollywood war film deals with the fact that before there's war, there's peace. And when there's peace, people tend to be oblivious to what's going on. And in Gone with the Wind, what a perfect start for the film, when they're just sitting around the plantation, talking about things, and not really understanding what the impact of war is going to be.
Though the men are beginning to buckle on their swords, but it's still all gallantry and distant rumble.
And it's them, you know, they're getting themselves worked up to be patriotic and getting on their horses and charging and having a great time.
What are we going to hear?
We're going to hear a little bit just prior to the men are discussing the war, and the women are not very keen on the idea.
What do we care if we were expelled from college, Scarlett? The war's gonna start any day now, so we'd have left college anyhow.
War? Isn't it exciting, Scarlett? You know those fool Yankees think they want a war?
We'll show them.
Fiddle-dee-fee. War, war, war. This war talk's spoiling all the fun at every party this spring. I get so bored I could scream. Besides, there isn't going to be any war.
Not gonna be any war.
Why, honey, of course there's gonna be a war.
If either of you boys says war, just once again, I'll go in the house and slam the door.
But Scarlett,
don't
honey,
you want us to have a war?
Wait a minute, Scarlett, honey, please.
Well, but remember, I warned you.
Gone with the Wind, Scarlet O'Hara, Vivian Leigh, fiddle-dee-dee, war, war, war. Jack Beatty, can anyone have that attitude anymore? That seems so historically placed. After the Great War, after World War II, after the Vietnam War, can anyone in America say fiddle-dee-dee, war, war, war?
I don't think so, but I think that, you know, if you watch television, if you watch CNN as I do, I could imagine, if you didn't have any other connection to war, feeling that way. I mean, it is a show we're being prepared for. We're going to see this terrific show, Countdown with Iraq. And the language that's used, it isn't, you know, we're going to be bombing Baghdad. There are people living there. Some of them, many maybe, are going to be killed. It isn't that. It's we're going to take out Saddam. We're going to topple Saddam. So even the verbs are hiding the reality from us. So, yes, I think that that kind of, if not that exuberance, that at least the sort of spectatorial innocence is preserved for the TV watcher today.
Or somehow capturing here also in Gone with the Wind the way that in the run-up to each war, we're once again surrounded by this veil of innocence about it, about what the costs may be. It's light. It's mint juleps and sitting in the shade of the old oak tree here, Gary.
Yeah, it is. And once again, I mean, you know, exactly what Jack is talking about. We as a country have not experienced any of the hardship of war per se. Just like Scarlett O'Hara, she has no idea that in 4 years she is going to have lost her plantation, her father's going to go crazy. You know, these are some of the consequences of war, and yet right now we're looking at this very distantly and we're not understanding. In many ways, America is very innocent, just like Scarlett O'Hara was just prior to her war.
From out of that innocence, even if there is this perpetual pre-war naivete, leaders have to muster the willingness to actually pick up the arms and go. Hollywood doesn't spend too long in the fiddle-dee-dee, war phase. They want to get to the blood-stirring stuff. There's, of course, the famous speech from Patton we're going to hear. Garen Daly, remind us about this film, about who we're going to hear speaking, and the context in which this film was made.
George Scott is playing George Patton, and, you know, it's 1970 when this film came out. At the height of the anti-war Vietnam sentiment, and this is a very much of a rah-rah film, and especially the speech that we're about to hear, exhorting people, exhorting young men that they're going to war and they're going to do their responsibility, they're going to do their duty for God and country. It's a classic speech. George C. Scott is terrific in it. He gets nominated, and I believe he wins an Oscar for this one.
Jack, what should we listen for in this speech?
Well, you got to have in mind that this is the son, the grandson of a Confederate colonel who died on the battlefield, that this is a man who shot three of Pancho Villa's men in a gun battle, a man who loved war.
Here in the Ark of War, from Patton, George C. Scott, essentially with the call to arms.
Some of you boys, I know, are wondering whether or not you'll chicken out under fire. Don't worry about it. I can assure you that you will all do your duty. The Nazis are the enemy. Wade into them. Spill their blood. Shoot them in the belly. When you put your hand into a bunch of goo that a moment before was your best friend's face, you know what to do. Now, there's another thing I want you to remember. I don't want to get any messages saying that we are holding our position. We're not holding anything. Let the Hun do that. We are advancing constantly, and we're not interested in holding on to anything except the enemy. We're going to hold on to him by the nose, and we're going to kick him in the ass. We're going to kick the hell out of him all the time, and we're going to go through him like crap through a goose. There's one thing that you men will be able to say when you get back home. And you may thank God for it. 30 years from now, when you're sitting around your fireside with your grandson on your knee, and he asks you, what did you do in the great World War II? You won't have to say, well, I shoveled shit in Louisiana. All right, now you sons of bitches, you know how I feel. I will be proud to lead you wonderful guys into battle anytime anywhere.
And here, at this point in the arc of war, Jack Guerin, the veil drops, and General George Patton, George C. Scott, is making a kind of speech that American troops will hear soon, somewhere around the world, in the Middle East, saying, look, forget about all the gauzy TV ads and the run-up. Now we're getting down to the real thing. Wade into them. Shoot them in the belly. You're going to have your hand in the goo that was your best friend's face a minute ago. Here's the down and dirty. Get ready to go, guys.
Yes, and it's just Scott talking in front of a mammoth American flag. And this movie actually enters history. Richard Nixon saw it twice the weekend he made the decision to invade Cambodia.
How funny, though, that we should have heard it at the height of the Vietnam War when there were protesters in the streets almost everywhere, as if we needed this throwback message or to find our footing again. I mean, there was controversy around it. George C. Scott, I think, was even ambivalent ultimately about it. But it played.
It played, and it played well. And one of the things that about it is, despite the fact that he is this rah-rah military guy, he's also kind of iconoclastic. He's also breaking the things. He's breaking the normal rules of military, and I think that appealed to the young people at the time. I remember when I first saw it back in 1970, I liked the fact that here was a guy inside the traditional military role being a bit of a rebel, pushing things, being, you know, going for it and wanting to win because, again, the enemy was someone who was clearly evil. And we needed to have a leader like George Patton to be able to lead us to victory.
But it's not enough to say that you're going to have to wade into them and shoot them in the belly at some point. Men, women now, need to understand, need to feel why. We want to hear a clip here from Gettysburg. This is Jeff Daniels. And Jack, again, set us up for this clip about why we fight.
This is Jeff Daniels playing Colonel Joshua Chamberlain, real character, former president of Bowdoin College. When he entered the Army, he didn't even know how to salute, and he basically saved the Union. These are 100 men he's talking to who could have faced court-martial, could have faced being shot for not wanting to fight, and he's trying to persuade them to fight. And he succeeds. And these men with him turn the tide of battle on Cemetery Ridge. They charge down at the rebels when they run out of ammunition and save the Union.
Let's hear it. Jeff Daniels in Gettysburg.
All of us volunteered to fight for the Union, just as you did. Some came mainly because we were bored at home. Thought this looked like it might be fun. Some came because we were ashamed not to. Many of us came because it was the right thing to do. All of us have seen men die. This is a different kind of army. If you look back through history, you will see men fighting for pay, for women, for some other kind of loot. They fight for land, power, because a king leads them, or just because they like killing. But we are here for something new. This has not happened much in the history of the world. We are an army out to set other men free. America should be free ground. All of it. Not divided by a line between slave state and free. All the way. From here to the Pacific Ocean. No man has to bow. No man born to royalty. Here we judge you by what you do, not by who your father was. Here you can be something. Here is the place to build a home. But it's not the land. It's always more land. It's the idea that we all have value. You and me. What we're fighting for, in the end, we're fighting for each other.
War as noble, war as the road to freedom. There is always that moment, Guerin Daly, when the reason has to be laid out and the soldier is given that path to walk on.
Yeah, and I have to say that I love this speech by Jeff Daniels because it really does give you a higher meaning to why you're fighting. And I think for a lot of people, that's really important.
It's always a piece. It's always a piece in Hollywood, but that can fall apart under fire. We're talking about Hollywood and the arc of war. We'll be back in just a moment with the combat phase of the arc of war. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about Hollywood and the arc of war, the time of innocence before war, the call to arms, the why we fight, and of course, ultimately, the actual combat. I'm joined tonight by Garen Daly and Jack Beatty. We're coming up on that combat moment here, Garen, and of course, this is maybe what Hollywood was born for.
Yeah, this is exactly, because not only is it very exciting and stimulating and makes really good cinema with lots of action and a lot of things going on, but they try and bring it down to the individual level. They try and show what it is like for a human being, a man or a woman, mostly men, to be caught inside a war and what the physical and psychological terror and strain that is going to happen. And it becomes very dramatic, very powerful. And in Stanley Kubrick's Paths of Glory, which is essentially an anti-war film, he shows World War I in a very unfavorable light.
We're going to hear that in just a minute. But as I think of the combat portion, so many scenes come to mind. And the most elemental ones are the ones we've seen again and again where men are massed on two sides of the field. They go out and they essentially butcher one another. It's awful, but Hollywood does it again and again and again. Gladiator, we heard at the top, Braveheart, zillions of others. We've all seen them. Jack, is that the kind of presentation of war, just men on a red blood red field?
I think so. I mean, Birth of a Nation, of course, has a great scene just showing that of a Union attack on a rebel redoubt and then the rebels charging back. And spectacle is what the movies are all about. But, you know, what really lives in movies are the small moments that take the innocence of a Scarlett O'Hara and put it in a young boy when he's getting, and that phrase, his baptism of fire in a movie like John Huston's Red Badge of Courage, where we see what that innocence coming up against this horrific reality is like.
Let's move into combat with Stanley Kubrick's 1957 Paths of Glory.
You're tired, Dax.
You're very tired. It's you who are exhausted, not your men. And it's my fault. I've given you one impossible task after another. You need rest. You need it badly. And you never would either. Therefore, you're not going to have any say-so about it, Colonel. As from right now, I'm ordering you on indefinite furlough.
General, you can't take me away from my men. You can't do that to me, sir.
Not to you, Dax. For you. For your good and for the good of your men.
The good of my men, sir.
If a commanding officer lacks confidence, what can we expect of his men? Naturally, I don't want to relieve you, but I must have your enthusiastic support. Not once have you said that your men can take the anthill.
We'll take the anthill. If any soldiers in the world can take it, we'll take the anthill.
There in Paths of Glory, Stanley Kubrick's 1957 film, is combat from the officer's vantage point, back at the tent, behind the lines, making decisions that we know from the bullets and the booming in the background is going to be carried out by the grunts.
They're the guys who are going to do all the bleeding, and they're the ones that are going to have their guts spilled out. And yes, the officers are the ones that make those very tough decisions. And again, Hollywood looks at that and tries to say, you know, they're making the decision for supposedly a bigger good, a better thing, or a better way of living.
But not in Kubrick's film.
But not in Kubrick's film. And that's where he makes a break from the traditional film. And the fact is that they say in this film that this was not a good idea, that this was wrong, and that that's why this particular film is an anti-war film rather than a regular war film.
Jack Beatty, I guess there's always a choice when the director comes to the combat portion. There will be spectacle. There's no question about that. But will it be spectacle that in its drama has a sheen of glory or a sheen of gore and horror?
Well, as we're hearing this sound, this is a scene in Kubrick's movie. It may be one of the longest tracking shots in movies. That is to say, the camera moving with the action. And the action is French soldiers advancing across no man's land, a mud waste, toward the German lines. And we're seeing men fall. We're seeing them fall into the muck. We're seeing the horrors of trench warfare. What we're seeing, of course, is absurdity. That this is absurd. That there is no taking of the anthill. And that's the message you're getting, and that the men are just sort of being led to the slaughter.
I guess it's a moment that makes me want to come back to the question again. In Hollywood's choreography of war, and here of the heart of war, of combat, whether it leans toward romanticizing war on balance, or whether it comes close to that sort of abject horror and even absurdity of war on balance.
I think this is definitely, excuse me.
That's great. I actually think, like Jack, that it has a tendency to romanticize it. It's very few, there are very few films that bring it down to this kind of level. And I think it's interesting to note that some of the better films have been directed by people who have been in war. William Wellman in Wings, Sam Fuller in The Big Red One, Oliver Stone in Platoon. I mean, these are people who've been there, and yet they still try to maybe rationalize it, that it is something to be glorified. Even though there is horror in it, there's something to be glorified.
You can't make that combat scene, Jack Beatty, as a director, without making a decision, without setting out a position on how you want to treat and present this activity.
It's very true, and it's interesting to see what Japanese directors do it. The great Kurosawa in Ran and Kagamusha, he shows this incredible, splendiferous spectacle of battle.
Making it into a ballet, an aesthetic treatment.
Yes. And so other cultures have this same issue with war, that the spectacle of it, the sheer aesthetics of it, the pennants, the guidons, the men shrieking, the streaks of light, the cascades of bullets, all of that is just too aesthetically irresistible for the director.
It's really another facet here beyond our kind of bipolar look at it. I mean, I think of American cinema, combat is glorious or it's gruesome. Not so much. That's the Japanese notion you say in Kurosawa, and of course, the beauty, the aesthetic splendor of war. Mm-hmm. Though I guess we touch that sometimes in Hollywood as well, Gary.
The aesthetic
splendor.
Yeah, and you can even see it in the modern films today, like even the Lord of the Rings with that wonderful battle scene at Helm's Deep. Very ballet-like, very impressive. Hollywood loves that kind of spectacle.
Of course, the guns eventually stop, and then there's a decision. What do we make of what just happened? Again, the director, the story, the plot of the screenplay is on the line here. Whether this was worthwhile, this was triumph, this was to be proud of, whether this was a waste, whether people come out enhanced and grown from war or destroyed.
Or sometimes they become kind of cynical. They've seen the war. They've seen what it's done to their friends. And, you know, they end up going home and seeing their old world again, and they have problems with it. It really, the disparity between the two views of the home life and the war life are just so great.
There's a moment in All Quiet on the Western Front that captures some of this, as a trooper brings that home view back to the battlefront.
Yes, right. And it's Lew Ayres, 1930. Again, this is only 12 years after World War One, and Lew Ayres plays a young German soldier who goes home and has a very difficult time with the adjustment there. He finally comes back to see his old buddy in the trenches.
Tell me, Paul, how's it at home? Have a good leave? In spots. What's the matter?
Oh, I'm no good for back there anymore, Cat. None of us are. We've been in this too long. The young men thought I was a coward because I told them that we learned that death stronger than duty one's country. The old men said, go on, push on to Paris. My father even wanted me to wear my uniform around. It's not home back there anymore. All I could think of was, I'd like to get back and see Cat again. You're all I've got left, Cat.
I'm not much to have left. I missed you, Paul.
At least we know what it's all about out here. There are no lies here.
Push on to Paris. You ought to see what they've got on the other side. They eat white bread over there. They've got dozens of airplanes to all one, and tanks that'll go over anything. What have we got? Guns so worn they drop shells on our own men. No food, no ammunition, no officers. Push on to Paris. So that's the way they talk back there.
There, Jack, in All Quiet on the Western Front, a little fuzzy from 1930, but still we hear it. And this notion that soldiers come to live or survive into kind of isolation, that people on the home front can't stand, that they're bereft in a way, they've seen too much at the same time, and nowhere is home anymore for them, Jack.
Yes, the philosopher and Marine veteran of World War II, J. Glenn Gray, wrote a book about this, and he said that that really one of the perverse secrets of war is love, that it is love that holds a group together, and that men who can't love, men who can't bond with others, are the ones who crack. They're the ones who lose their nerve. They turn away from their fellows. And that this experience of love, of I will sacrifice my life for you and you for me, is one of the terrible secrets of war, because it's the best in human beings used often in the worst.
We see in All Quiet on the Western Front, of course, the great anti-war film, as you say, Ghirardelli, coming out of World War One. But yet the movies go on their own life cycle. I mean, we go through a phase where it's anti-war, and then the pro-war or the splendor of war comes back again.
Yeah, the splendor comes back because we've forgotten and we have lost it, or the political situation has changed. But, you know, once a war has ended, we have a tendency to go back and take a look at what the actual toll was on a personal level, on a societal level, on many different kinds of level. It seems that the best war movies, or the movies that have the greatest impact on us, are films that are made after a war, when we've got the ability to gain perspective. All Quiet on the Western Front was made 12 years after World War One. Wings was made 10 years after World War One. And 12 O'Clock High, you know, made 4 years after the war. We're looking at a person, Gregory Peck, who is a commander of a flotilla of bombers doing daylight bomb raids on Germany. The price that he pays as an individual to make that maximum effort to try and win the war, it's really devastating to him. But that could only be done after the war. They couldn't do it before the war, mm-hmm. or during the war. They had to make films that are patriotic. It's only afterwards that we can look at that toll.
But here in 12 O'Clock High, the director goes back and brings us that complete burnout.
What do you make of it? State of shock, complete collapse. Everything let go at once.
Well, can't you give him a hypodoc, something to knock him out, put him to sleep?
No, in his present condition, it wouldn't be any good. He's somewhere up there with the mission. When they get back, maybe he'll let go. I hope.
It's screwy. I would never figure it could happen to him.
I did. I watched him sweep his feelings under the carpet long enough. Had to spill out Sunday.
But I never saw him more full of fight than he was at briefing.
You ever see a light bulb burn out? How bright the filament is just before it lets go? I think they call it maximum effort.
Maximum effort and the bright leading to the burnout of the soldier in 12 O'Clock High. Jack, what do you make of Hollywood's pendulum here, of the love-hate relationship with war? Is it a direct parallel of our political conversation? You know, we have the moment where we've just been through it and it's just too much and no one wants the taste of war in their mouth, and then slowly the willingness to accept and engage creeps back again. Is Hollywood a creature of that same human cycle?
I think so, and in this movie, we see the psychiatric front of war. I was recently looking at a 1942 study done by psychiatrists of the psychiatric symptoms among Army Air Force bomber crews, just these people as in the movie. And the study talks about what they call conversion reactions, that is, people taking the stress and returning it into physical symptoms, twitching, vomiting, irritability, diarrhea, compulsion. And it warns that the stress almost seeks out the unhealed seams of early trauma within the people, and that's the men who crack, who have some early burden that the stress just finds remorselessly.
And even after all that, Hollywood wants to come back and put the monument on war that says, for all the mayhem and chaos and insanity and suffering, there was something worthwhile here. In that way, it plays a kind of the role of a preacher or a national consoler after the war. In Saving Private Ryan, there's that moment at the end where he stands by the grave and, through all the bitterness, feels that, well, even so, maybe this was all right. There's the moment where the letter comes to the mother who's lost so many sons, the mother of the Ryans, from General, was it Marshall?
It was Marshall, yes. Yeah.
And he gives her that consoling message. Let's listen to that, to hear this kind of headstone, the monument, the consolation that Hollywood wants to bring to the losses of war.
My dear Mrs. Ryan, it's with the most profound sense of joy that I write to inform you your son, Private James Ryan, is well and at this very moment on his way home from European battlefields. Reports from the front indicate James did his duty in combat with great courage and steadfast dedication, even after he was informed of the tragic loss your family has suffered in this great campaign to rid the world of tyranny and oppression. I take great pleasure in joining the Secretary of War, the men and women of the United States Army, and the citizens of a grateful nation in wishing you good health and many years of happiness with James at your side. Nothing, not even the safe return of a beloved son, can compensate you or the thousands of other American families who have suffered great loss in this tragic war. But I might share with you some words which have sustained me through long dark nights of peril, loss, and heartache. And I quote, I pray that our Heavenly Father may assuage the anguish of your bereavement and leave you only the cherished memory of the loved and lost and the solemn pride that must be yours to have laid so costly a sacrifice upon the altar of freedom. Abraham Lincoln.
From Saving Private Ryan, the words there of General George Marshall to the mother who has lost many sons and will have one who lives. Here, I'm struck, Jack Beatty, at how 50 years after the end of that war, we were clearly, when this film came out, as a nation, still hungry to feel the wounds of that five-decade-distant war bound and salved by Hollywood.
Yes, and this movie, I think, has a kind of split-screen effect. It's a Steven Spielberg movie, which means it goes for explicitness, for getting as lifelikeness as possible.
But also a certain sweetness at the edge.
That's right. And that altar of freedom, my gosh, that's the corpses heaped up on it. And we feel that in this film because when the film it begins with a 20-minute battle, that for some audiences was just too much.
On the Normandy beach.
Yeah, just the sound of the bullets going into men's flesh, just the realism of that, or at least the seeming realism of it, was a new level of explicitness in war films, as was the showing Americans shooting prisoners.
Mm-hmm. But after all that, Hollywood's good at letting the gauze of glory settle back over all the remains. We're talking tonight about Hollywood and the arc of war. Our feet are set on that path, on that arc right now. Hollywood has treated it for most of a century. We'll be back to look at more films and more perspective from the silver screen. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about Hollywood and the arc of war. I'm joined by our movie maven, Garen Daly, and by On Point news analyst, Jack Beatty. We've looked at how Hollywood treats the pre-war innocence, the call to arms, the why we fight, combat, second thoughts, burnout, pride. And then comes the moment when Hollywood can turn and, in some dimension, take its vengeance, if it chooses to, bring back a very bitter view. Let's listen here to a clip of Born on the 4th of July.
What's going on? Are you drunk again?
Hey, Mom.
He's drunk again. Eli, we have a drunk for a son. You can't stay in this house.
This is what you believe in, isn't it, Mom? This is what you believe in, but I don't.
You can't stay in this house.
I don't believe in him anymore.
Go to bed, honey.
Because he only had to spend 3 days up there. Me, I got to spend the rest of my life. I wish I were dead like him.
You don't know what you're saying.
That's the problem, Mom. I'm not dead. I got to live. I got to live and I got to roll around. I got to remind him of Vietnam. And you don't want to know, you don't want to see us, you want to hide us. You want to hide us because it is a cannon. And I am a dummy.
He won't listen, he won't change.
Ronnie, please, you got to take your mom seriously. You can't drink in this house.
Everything they told us.
Go fight, go kill. Sergeant, man, Marine, car. Yes, car left, car left, car left.
You know, it's all a lie. Look out.
Come on, Amy.
Why? Stop it. Go to bed. You sleep it off.
What did they do to you in that war? What happened to you? You need help, Ronnie. You need help.
You need help.
And there we're a long way from glory with Tom Cruise in Born on the 4th of July. Garen Daly, he's waving a crucifix at the beginning and saying, you believe in this, and he clearly believes in, can believe in nothing anymore.
Well, his life is completely destroyed. When we were listening earlier to Vivian Leigh with her innocence, this is the opposite end of that. This is a man who has been, his soul has been ripped off, his legs have been lost, and he's in anguish, he's in trauma, he's in post-traumatic stress syndrome. He's fighting just to be able to figure out why he should be living. And this is the personal cost that he has to endure for the rest of his life. And he has to make a transition. And what I like about what Stone does with this film...
Oliver Stone directed
this film, who, you know, again, is based on some of his own experiences, is he helps our country go through the same kind of steps. Because as a country, we ended up going into Vietnam very innocent. You know, very much like The Quiet American, which is just coming out now, talking about, you know, our views of what was going on. We got our tush handed to us, and we ended up learning from that. So now, when you hear the Colin Powells of the world, or the generals and the commanders, they need to know that we have the country behind them be able to fight a war. We can't do what we did to Tom Cruise in the Born on the 4th of July.
And yet, Jack Beatty, every war produces some of this, and in a way, this is Oliver Stone testifying and saying, I've made a cinematic record here that will not, cannot be forgotten because it's on film.
Yes, and it's our whole arc. I mean, from the innocence, we see him listening to President Kennedy's inaugural address, bear any price, pay any price, bear any burden, that great sort of vaunting American pride. He's gung-ho to get into the war. He hears the speeches justifying it. We see what combat is, and then we see the aftermath. And this is the story of Ron Kovic. And last weekend, Ron Kovic spoke at the anti-war demonstration in Washington, and he was in his wheelchair. And he said that he did not want what happened to him to happen to others.
The real life intersecting with Hollywood, intersecting with a real war in the offing. But war has now become so fast, where films always dwelt on World War I films, on the endless days in the trenches. Now it's a matter of weeks, of days. It's war at top speed. We've got a clip here from Three Kings, which came out after the Gulf War. Didn't produce much in the way of cinema, the Gulf War, but this was quite an extraordinary film about, well, sort of the privateering underbelly of war, Garen.
Yeah, it's about three guys who are going to make a big score, financial big score, at the end of the war and steal Saddam Hussein's gold. But little do they realize that they're going to have something else creep into their way and change their lives.
Three Kings.
Saddam. What do you see here?
Bunkers, sir.
What are in those bunkers?
Stuff they stole from Kuwait.
Bullshit. I'm talking about millions in Kuwaiti bullion.
You mean them little cubes you put in hot water to make soup?
No, not the little cubes you put in hot water to make soup.
Gold bricks, Conrad.
Saddam stole it from the sheiks. I have no problem stealing it from Saddam. My guess is he's divided these bricks into several different stashes. Just one of these stashes would be easy for us to take from his deserting army. And that would be enough to get us out of our day jobs. Unless, of course, you reservists are in love with your day jobs.
American soldiers who won't be saps in Three Kings. War may be high speed, but they're going to get their peace at the end. Jack Beatty, with that, we come to the full arc, maybe. The gold ends up to be, a higher price than they expected to pay in the pursuit of it, as war often is. You've got something there that takes us right off the film and back down to earth.
Yes. Walt Whitman, who treated veterans in military hospitals in the Civil War, says the real war never gets into the books, and it never gets into the movies either. It's an experience beyond it. But it gets close, and it's getting closer. And one of the places, one of the books that got closest was in Wilfred Owen's great poem, Dulce et Decorum Est, which is from Horace. It is sweet and honorable to die for your country. Wilfred Owen was a British war poet. He died exactly 1 week before the armistice. This is 15 lines from the poem about a gas gas attack. Gas, gas, quick boys, an ecstasy of fumbling, fitting the clumsy helmets just in time. But someone still was yelling out and stumbling and floundering like a man in fire or lime, dim through the misty panes and thick green light as under a green sea. I see him drowning. In all my dreams before my helpless sight, he plunges at me, guttering, choking, drowning. If you could hear the blood come gargling from the froth corrupted lungs, obscene as cancer, bitter as the cud of vile, incurable sores on innocent tongues. My friend, you would not tell with such high zest to children ardent for some desperate glory the old lie, dulce et decorum est pro patria mori.
There it is. We read the poem, and we see the silver screen, and we prepare once again for war.
Yeah, and I think I would like to close out with talking about Sam Fuller, who said you could never experience a war in a movie theater unless you think that there is a sniper behind the screen ready to shoot at you.
And every president has to know that films will be made on his war as well. Garen Daly, thanks for being with us tonight. Jack Beatty, thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. In a moment, I'll be rejoined by On Point news analyst Jack Beatty. First, let's listen back to the sounds of this past week.
Iraq has now placed itself in danger of the serious consequences called for in UN Resolution 1441. And this body places itself in danger of irrelevance if it allows Iraq to continue to defy its will without responding effectively and immediately.
The evidence that Secretary Powell presented today, it seems to me, makes the case against Saddam stronger and stronger and clearer and clearer.
There are incorrect allegations, unnamed sources, unknown sources. There are assumptions and presumptions which all fall in line with the American policy towards one known objective.
Inspections regime favored by Resolution 1441 must be strengthened. The use of force can only be a final recourse. Why go to war if there still exists some unused space in Resolution 1441?
After conferring this morning with the Homeland Security Council, the decision has been made to increase the threat condition designation currently classified at elevated risk, to increase that threat condition designation to the high risk category.
We are dealing with an unpredictable regime and a regime that seems to be moving along a ladder of escalation in terms of its actions that is a matter of some concern. But what Secretary Rumsfeld has done in putting those bombers on alert is simply to reinforce our deterrent posture and to make sure that North Korea doesn't do anything adventurous or dangerous of a military kind.
The final days of their own lives were spent looking down upon this earth. And now on every continent, in every land they could see, the names of these astronauts are known and remembered.
And there's a week, Secretary of State Colin Powell, with a very big week, presenting evidence there before the United Nations Security Council that the U.S. contends shows Iraq is in violation of Resolution 1441. Powell's presentation lauded on Capitol Hill as Democrat Joe Lieberman and other Democrats say the Secretary made a compelling case for war. Iraq's ambassador to the United Nations, Mohammed Al-Douri, accuses Powell of fabricating evidence. France's U.N. ambassador says Powell's evidence convinces him that it is time to intensify weapons inspections, not war. Attorney General John Ashcroft today announcing that the national threat level has been raised to high. That's the orange stripe. Deputy Secretary of Defense Paul Wolfowitz explains the Pentagon's decision to put 24 long-range bombers on alert in the Pacific as the standoff with North Korea escalates, at least rhetorically. And President Bush honors the 7 astronauts who died aboard the Space Shuttle Columbia at a ceremony outside Mission Control. Jack Colin Powell, really the man of the hour this week, putting the evidence and his credibility right out there on the line.
Yes, and his credibility is all the stronger because, really, since 9/11, he's been resisting the Iraq adventure. And only in the last 3 weeks has he really turned around, and instrumental in that, if not decisive in that, was the way he was treated by the French at the UN a couple of weeks ago. But his, you know, his report, his presentation was really aimed right at the objection that the French and others have made to, you know, to war. They have said, listen, just having the inspectors there is a good thing. They'll find stuff. They'll slow it down. He says no. He says, you know, they've got. He shows materials being evacuated from 30 chemical weapons plants. He shows 18 mobile, or he claims there are 18 of these mobile weapon factories producing chemical weapons in biological weapons where the inspectors can't find them. In short, he shows how the inspections themselves are being cheated on by Saddam.
But a galling process for the French and Germans. President Bush this week saying, look, the game is over. It's game over with Saddam. And everybody in the Bush White House saying they'd like a new resolution from the UN to actually proceed to military action, but they don't need it. So what's it going to be, UN? Will you be irrelevant? That's not the kind of leadership that the French and Germans at least want the UN to show.
No, it's not, although the French, in their usual realistic way, have dispatched an aircraft carrier to the Middle East, and according to today's paper, they're now busy making their munitions compatible with American munitions if they, in fact, have to go to war. So they're still talking peace, but sending the carrier and changing the ammunition signs that that even the French are getting ready for war.
So maybe not a veto there, maybe not even a vote, maybe not a push for a new resolution. Though interestingly, Tony Blair continues to say that he needs it. He wants it. That many Britons are not on board without it.
82% say we do not go to war without UN approval.
At home, the terror threat level up today, one of those vague, new, strange things we live with. It shows up suddenly on the TV screen when you're, you know, passing by the television sales store or at the gym. And what does it mean? You know, do you change your posture when you see the threat level rise to orange, Jack?
Well, you know, listening to CNN this afternoon, they were saying, well, what should Americans do at shopping centers? What should they do at sporting events? Let's think about this. Maybe you need to think twice before you do these matters. And, you know, while they were doing this, they were quoting a man who was from the former officer in the Coast Guard who was on the Hart commission that looked into our preparedness. And this fellow was saying, we're not ready. We haven't done anything. And underscoring what we've heard on this program, that the emphasis of the Bush administration has been on offense, not on defense.
But one can only imagine that this may not be crying wolf at all, that it would make a great or a terrible, depending how you look at it, time for a strike.
It certainly would, and it's just to simply see these things and hear these things brings home the new world we're in and reminds us that in prodding the Iraqi nest, we are kicking up almost inevitably more of this.
Well, and I hope not too much, but this week many people listening to Colin Powell and saying, I have heard plenty of people this week listen and say, but gosh, don't we have to deal with it? Isn't it just sitting there to be dealt with? Colin Powell did seem to make a persuasive case for some, many, you read the polls any way you like, Americans, that sitting back is not an option.
6 in 10 Americans found him very convincing, and President Bush's approval rating went up about 6 points itself.
Jack, thanks for being with us tonight.
Thank you.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.